Welcome to The Program, a podcast dedicated to exposing the institutional child abuse that occurred at the hands of WASP, or Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs, an organization that owned a network of dozens of schools that systemically abused at-risk teens and exploited their parents for millions of dollars. This podcast aims to expose those responsible and seek justice for the damage caused to the innocent children who endured unspeakable abuse. This podcast is for the survivors. I dedicate this to you. Welcome back to Inside the Program. This is your host, Caroline Lorson. Today, Christy, a survivor of Red Cliff Ascent in the Family Foundation School, is going to share with us one of the most incredible stories yet. After enduring abuse at home and being made to believe that she was a full-blown addict after only experimenting with weed, Christy was sent to a wilderness program. But the 63 days she spent surviving off the land in Utah would not prepare her for the horrors she would experience at the Family Foundation School. After successfully escaping the program, Christy ran for her life and would stay in hiding until after she turned 18. Her story is one of courage and survival. But before we start the episode, I have a few messages for you. I just want to say thank you to everyone who has been leaving ratings and reviews on the iTunes platform, and I wanted to share a few of them with you now. The first message reads, "Thank you so much, Caroline, and all the other survivors who have shared their story so far. My sibling was at Spring Creek Lodge for 2 years in the early 2000s. I was in elementary school at the time. I saw what that experience did to them, but I never really understood why until recently. I've been listening to and reading the experiences of other survivors to educate myself and to try to better understand what they went through. I have so much love for all of the survivors sharing their stories here and elsewhere. I know it must not be easy to do this. I am sending you my love and support." Thank you so much for that beautiful review. We have just a couple more. Here is another one. This person says, "I grew up near Ogdensburg and only..." This is where the Academy at Ivy Ridge is located, by the way. So this person says, "I grew up near Ogdensburg and only have a brief recollection of Ivy Ridge. I cannot believe this all went on and so close to home. Thank you so much for shedding light on this. Your Your courage speaks volumes, and we are listening." Thank you so much. I think I speak for most survivors when I say that it has been one of the most rewarding experiences actually being heard. Okay, so I have one more, and this person, the subject says, "Sped up podcast, it's not clear." Then they say, "I'm trying to listen, but everything is sped up. Can y'all change the speed and slow it down?" Okay, so I will let you know, I do not alter the speed of any of the episodes, but if for some reason you're just wanting to really listen and engage with each word, iTunes, if you're listening on the podcast platform for Apple or iTunes, if you open the episode, I found this out the other day, actually, which is super cool. If you open the episode, down in the lower left-hand corner, you're going to see a little purple button that says 1X. And if you tap that, it will change the speed of the episode. So you can speed it up if you want it faster, or you can slow it down if you would really like to comprehend each and every word. I know there's a lot of content, so I hope that that helps you. Also, if you have not yet signed Paris Hilton's petition on change.org to shut down Provo Canyon School, go do that now. It only takes a second and it will literally save children's lives. So go get your good karma boost and tap that link below in the description to sign the petition. And just a reminder, this podcast is solely operated on donations. So if you would like to continue hearing episodes of exposing the troubled teen industry and survivor stories, please make a donation. You're welcome to donate through the Anchor app. Just tap the button on the home screen that says support, or you are welcome to donate through Cash App. And my Cash App handle is $FuckWasp. It is FuckWasp. And that is on Cash App. So thank you ahead of time. We have actually received a few donations this week. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much to everyone who is supporting this podcast and just sharing it on social media. It is such a blessing and it just furthers our power and our ability to mobilize this movement. So thank you to you, everyone who is taking part in that. Now, without further ado, let's welcome our guest, Christy. Hello, Christy. Welcome to the podcast. We're so excited to have you.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So you have an incredible story from what I've heard of it, and I'm so excited to get an even more in-depth, up-close, personal account of what it was like. So give us an idea. What were the programs that you went to, and how long were you there?
I went to Red Cliff Ascent, which is a wilderness program in St. George, Utah, in the desert. I was there for 2, maybe 3 months in 1996. And then I went from there to the Family Foundation School in Hancock, New York, which was listed as a therapeutic boarding school. I had already graduated high school early, so I was supposedly going there and going to be able to go to college at Binghamton College in New York.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That's incredible. So, well, we are going to get into that because we got to hear what happened and what your actual experience was like. Give us the backstory. What happened? What happened inside your family? What happened inside your home that led up to this point that you were sent to the wilderness program?
My family was very conservative, religious family. We didn't talk about a lot of things at home. I was sexually abused as a child by a relative, and that was swept under the rug. We weren't allowed to talk about it. I had to continue seeing that person at holidays. When I finally became around 14, and found my voice, and I said that was no longer acceptable and I did not want to go to holidays and be around this person. And that kind of really made a big divide in my family, and everybody was really upset with me, and I really wished I would have never disclosed the abuse.
Do you feel that way now?
Yes, if I could go back to being a kid, I would have never, ever said anything because it just brought me so much more pain and damage by disclosing than it caused by telling the truth. Telling the truth had massive repercussions for me. Wow. So it was definitely, life was changed ever since I told what had happened. And it was not at all accepted by my family, and they did send me to therapy and to a counselor. Mm-hmm. But that was the only place I was allowed to talk about that. Nobody else in the family was allowed to talk about it or talk to me about it. It was just, it happened and that was it.
Yeah, that can create a lot of shame. Like you said, even just regret of feeling like I just never should have even said anything at all.
Yes, I was such a goody two-shoes before then, like so much so. In my eighth grade year, I was voted most likely to do homework over vacation. So not best hair, not best eyes, most likely to do homework over vacation. So
that's funny. Okay, that paints a picture. We see that. Okay, yeah.
Yes. At 14... I did start acting out a little bit. No, it was more about 15. I was also diagnosed with ulcerative colitis around that time. So I was going through medical issues as well. My family was not hearing me when I was saying that I was hurting, that I needed help. I would say that I was depressed and I wasn't really listened to. I believe I had my first suicide attempt at about 15. That suicide attempt, of course, was just humiliating for me. I remember, of course, my mom told the school about it, and somehow everybody at school knew. So when I got back to school, I can remember a classmate shaking a bottle of Tylenol pills at me and kids laughing about it. I ended up switching schools that year. I'd been in a lot of private schools. So my freshman year, I'd actually gone to a pretty well-known boarding school that was very academic focused, that was hard to get into. So I felt like that was this great accomplishment. My brother had also gone to this school. I was feeling good about myself, but unfortunately that school didn't really work out well for me. I'd always been the best at everything that I did. And suddenly at that school where they had the best of the best, I was no longer the best at anything. So it was really hard for me. So we decided not to continue at that school. And sophomore year, I switched to a private Catholic school. And then that's when some problems started, emotional problems started coming out, the suicide attempt. I was in counseling. And I mean, I experimented a little bit with marijuana. I mean, nothing too crazy. Looking back, it was normal teenage experimentation.
Right. Yeah.
At the time, I was considered like a hardcore drug addict.
You're an addict.
You know,
you're on the devil's lettuce. Yeah.
Yes. 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 I mean, and I really thought I was. I was sent to NA with grown adults with real addiction
problems. Yeah, heroin addicts. You're in there with the.
Yes. And then And my family was telling me that I was a heroin addict. I was believing of it. I was believing that I was truly an addict. But looking back at that place in my life, then I, knowing now what I know about addiction and having actually become a true addict after the Family Foundation School, I definitely was not an addict at that age at all. It was just normal experimentation. So,
I feel like that is such a common story for so many kids who were sent to these programs, is that that type of stuff is normal. And I don't think that parents want to admit that. And but it is. We get curious. We know that there's things around. We want to know what it feels like to feel different. And eventually, I think a lot of people grow out of it. Right? You go out of it, you do different things, you get different interests. And yes.
Studies and statistics and the evidence actually proves that now. And many psychologists and psychiatrists have published articles stating just that, that most teenagers, if left to their own devices, will eventually outgrow the experimentation phase. So
yeah,
it's, yeah. Frustrating that all of us kids had to go through what we went through.
Well, and being shamed for it too, I think, is a big part of it. Just feeling like, am I an addict? Like you said, you believed at the time that you were an addict. And here you are sitting in NA going through the 12 steps. My heart feels for you. So what happened next? So there, you're going through NA, your parents are thinking you're an addict, you're thinking you're an addict. Meanwhile, you have an incredible amount of pain and other things that you were also coping with at that time. So,
and I was still a straight A student. I still lettered in varsity sports. I was very much a jock, so I did every sport that was available during every season. There was not one season that I wasn't in sports. So throughout this whole period, I still had straight A's. I was still in sports. I mean, looking back, this is not normal addict behavior. I didn't skip school. I wasn't missing school.
You were doing all the things. When did your parents actually decide, okay, she needs help more than what we can give, or whatever their thought pattern was. Maybe you can kind of enlighten us on that.
I believe that their thought pattern was I was about to turn 18 and they were going to lose control of me. I had already filled out a ton of college applications. I had been getting college acceptance letters. I was trying to figure out which college I wanted to go to. I had enough credits to graduate early. So it was not even 6 months before my 18th birthday. And I had had a few friends shipped off. So I was aware of the programs and I was aware of kidnappers showing up to your house in the middle of the night, big goons dressed in black, showing up, zip tying you, handcuffing you, taking kids out in the middle of the night. I had two of my best friends that had that happen to them. I was aware of kids just suddenly disappearing and nobody knowing where they went. It seemed to be a common thing that was happening in my area. Kids were being shipped off to these programs. I also grew up in a very wealthy area where families had the means to ship off kids that didn't meet the narrative that the family wanted them to meet.
Do you feel like some of that was about what other people thought about the family?
Oh, yes.
You know, what would other people think if they knew that our angelic daughter is smoking grass and...
Yes, or wearing hippie clothes and going to drum circles and not wearing preppy outfits and looking fancy and fitting in with the normal Santa Barbara narrative.
How did you get to the program? So the first program that you went to was the Wilderness Program.
I heard my parents. I'm a very intuitive person. And I heard my parents whispering on the phone and things got real secretive in my house. My house was always very secretive, but this was even more secretive than normal. One day I heard my mom on the phone whispering, "You can come now." I ran into my room and I opened up my window and I jumped out the back window and I ran around the house out to the road. And I seen that there were cars and police cars pulled up at my house. I had never been in trouble with the law. I had never had any experience with the law. So this was very frightening to me. So I started running. Police officers were chasing after me. Oh, stop, stop. Finally, the police officers tackled me and I was handcuffed and I was put in the back of the police car. There was a psychiatrist, I believe, there. He said, "We want to talk to you. Do you want to talk here at the police station?" And I said, "At the police station." At that point, I didn't even want to see my parents again. Like, I was so scared of them. So I went willingly. I went to the police station and they said at the police station, the psychiatrist came in and said, "Well, do you want to see your parents or do you want to go get some help? Your parents have said you have a drug problem." I said, "Yes, I will go get some help." So they put me in an inpatient psychiatric center where I was for a week, where, of course, my parents hooked up with an education consultant and the therapist recommended programs for me, specifically programs that would take kids after they were 18 years old. So I remember looking through flyers of programs. I actually was gaslit so hard by my family, my psychiatrist, the education consultant, that I actually believed for many years that I chose to go to the programs because I did look at flyers. I looked at Turnaround Ranch, beautiful kids riding on horses and what an amazing experience, and Casa by the Sea. Oh, it looks great in Mexico and I could go to another country or...
Yeah, drinking coconuts and getting a tan.
Yes.
And yeah, you're thinking...
Yes. Yes, this sounds amazing. And honestly, anything to get out of my house was my thought. Like anything to get out of my house and not have to be back in my family dysfunctional dynamic. I was willing to do anything it took to get out of there. I ended up choosing a wilderness program because I love the woods and I love to hike. So I was sent off to Red Cliff Ascent first in St. George, Utah, and I didn't have to be kidnapped. I drove there willingly in the car with my parents. They dropped me off. We came into the office. We hugged goodbye. That was a little sad. I remember crying because I knew I wasn't going to see them for a long time. And I was, you know, sad about that. But I thought, I'm getting this help and I really need help because I'm so messed up and I'm just dysfunctional and I'm a broken person and I need this. And this is going to save my life. This program is going to save my life or I'm going to end up dead, in jail, or institutionalized. So then I was taken into a little closet and stripped down, stripped naked by a male staff, did a body cavity search, took my belongings, took all my personal possessions, gave me the normal khaki pants and khaki jacket and the blanket roll backpack and the supplies for the wilderness program. And I got blindfolded and then they put a black bag over my head, took me in a truck, drove for about an hour. And they said this way, the kids wouldn't know which way if they tried to run. And that's when I realized, oh, this isn't like an outward bound type wilderness program like I thought it was.
Right.
This is something totally different.
Right. If you're already seeing that they are making plans in case of the event that you would want to run, you're thinking, what would I possibly want to run from? I bet this is not very therapeutic.
Yes. Yes. Looking back now as an adult, my parents had given me a code word as well, which was green lizards. So in case anything happened or any abuse occurred in this program, all I had to do was drop that word, green lizard, into a letter. Like today I saw green lizards in the desert. And then my parents would know that this program was too abusive and they would pull me out.
So what ended up happening? So you drive an hour and some minutes out into whatever direction, you have no idea. And then they just drop you off? Or where are you with a group? Can you kind of explain that to me a little bit?
They took me out to the woods. I honestly don't remember much of that first day. Like, it is all just kind of a blur. I remember at night, all our shoes getting locked up in a bag. And if we had to go to a bathroom in the middle of the night, it was like the biggest issue because you had to wake somebody up to ask. And then you would get in trouble because the staff didn't like getting woken up. And you couldn't get your shoes out of the bag. So you're stumbling in the desert with cactus and sage poking at your bare feet while you're calling your number every 3 seconds. My number was 3. So three. You had to constantly call your number in the wilderness program anytime you were out of view of staff. Wilderness wasn't as hard for me as it was for a lot of kids that were there. I felt bad for those kids because I loved the woods and I love the mountains and I love to hike. I actually did okay at that program compared to some of the kids that came in that were city kids and didn't like the woods and weren't athletic and didn't like to hike.
Right.
Those kids had it really tough, like really tough. And I remember one boy, he refused to hike. And so we had to pick him up and we had to carry him 15 miles. Because he refused to hike because it was corporal punishment, right? One person in the group misbehaves or one person in the group doesn't stay in line, the whole group is punished. So if we didn't get to our destination where we were going to camp for the night, we were all punished. So we picked this boy up and we carried him. I remember, you know, other kids were really upset with this boy and they would drop him a few times on purpose as we were going up big hills. But on the other hand, this poor kid, you know, he had just come into the program. He was scared. He didn't know what was going on. He didn't want to hike. He'd been through traumatic events as well, been kidnapped in the middle of the night. And now the whole group hated him. Everybody hated him.
Wow. So now he's up there alone. The whole group hates him. You guys are still having to hike 15 miles. And like you said, I mean, who knows what his story was before he got to that place. So also what I'm hearing you say is that really they left you guys no room for an adjustment period, right? It was, you're here, let's go.
Oh yeah, definitely. That from that first day, if you wanted to eat and you couldn't start a fire, guess what? You didn't eat. And who knows how to start a fire with 2 sticks of wood straight out of the, you know, van. Nobody knows. I mean, Right. I do. I mean, maybe you do if you've been to a wilderness program, but I guarantee 80% of the population can't start a fire with two sticks of wood.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the only reason why I know is because I've watched maybe 100 hours of Naked and Afraid during quarantine.
Yeah.
But to be totally honest, I would not have known. And so to have your livelihood reliant upon that skill as a child... Let me ask you, what would they do if you got in trouble at this program? What would be the repercussion?
Well, I never really got in trouble too much because I was always very much of a rule follower. But I do remember that the same boy that we had to carry, we were gathering firewood one time and he threw his stack of firewood at me. He was upset with me for some reason and started yelling at me. The staff tied us together for 7 days straight. We were tied. So anytime we had to go to the bathroom, we had about 2 feet of leeway in between our arms. So anytime I had to go to the bathroom, he had to go with me. And we'd be calling our numbers out, pooping. For him, he had me right there 2 feet away. And of course, all the kids' stomachs were wrecked because you weren't eating a good diet. Everybody had diarrhea. Usually punishments was more hiking or food deprivation or emotional punishments.
That methodology is so incredibly dangerous and damaging because here you are coming from a background of abuse, and then you're having to use the restroom with someone right there. I mean, there's no autonomy. There's no sense of privacy. There's no sense of safety and security in your own body. Again, you know, what we know is that there's no scientific proof about any of this stuff.
And in February, it was so cold in the desert in Utah, and we had inadequate hiking gear. I've done a lot of Outward Bound courses, so I'm pretty proficient in the outdoors. And we did not have adequate, we did not have even 40 degree rated sleeping bags.
Oh, that's so dangerous.
Thin sleeping bags. We all had to scrunch together in what we called the burrito, where we would all scoot in as close as we could. So if there was a kid that refused to hike, or a kid that had too many accidents on themselves, that kid wouldn't be allowed to be in the burrito. Once again, that child would be ostracized for whatever issues they were having. It was pretty sad looking back. I got in line pretty quick, but still looking back on it, I don't always feel good about not standing up for the unrighteousness that occurred to other children that were there.
And I'm sure those kids in other ways have already been ostracized from their families, from society, from, you know, in so many other ways. And now here they are just back in that same position again, completely helpless, completely powerless. Wow.
That yes, is just- and you're being treated by counselors that are getting paid $10 an hour that have no college education.
Right.
Many of them were drug addicts themselves with no college education, no degrees, no certification, no classes, nothing to train them in how to deal with or be equipped to handle kids that have dealt with trauma and abuse.
Right.
And instead, they would use those items that your parents had given them to work on. Like, for example, my work on items were sexual abuse and adoption issues. And right. So they would use those and turn them against you. Your family doesn't want you. That's why you were adopted. You're not good enough. Nobody wants you. That's why you're here at Wilderness, because you don't fit in. You weren't good enough. You were never good enough. Nobody wants you. Nobody likes you. They would have to break you down so that they could build you up into the person they wanted you to be.
Right. Which is essentially the definition of brainwashing.
Yes.
Which I think is a lot of what we're finally starting to talk about now.
I remember there was a girl at Wilderness that disclosed that she had been raped, and everybody around the campfire, the staff began singling her out, saying that she was a manipulator. She had lied. She had made this up. And we all were forced to participate in tearing the scroll down for coming forward and admitting to being a rape victim, until eventually this poor girl said that she had never been a victim at all. She made the whole story up. And I've always felt for that girl and felt bad that I didn't stand up and say anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a child, you just trust the adults around you, like they know better, right? Mm-hmm. Little did we know that they didn't have our best interests in mind. They had the biggest wallet in mind.
You said you were at the Wilderness program for two to three months.
Yeah, I remember I graduated early. I think actually might have only been 2 months, because I think it was like 63 days I spent there. I remember they said that I was good. I didn't really need a program after that. You know, I was great, that I was one of the kids that they really didn't think needed to go to Wilderness. But one of my friends in the program, JC, was going to the Family Foundation School. And it sounded like a great place. And they went to Carnegie Hall. They went on these trips and had these music concerts that they were in. Their choir was supposedly renowned. And you could go to college there at Binghamton College in New York. And you could stay there up until you were 21 if you wanted. At that point, I had had it so ingrained in me that I needed the programs. I needed to stay somewhere. I needed somebody to have control over my life. I said, great, I will go to the Family Foundation School. Remember, I graduated from Red Cliff Ascent. My whole family came out.
So did you go directly from Red Cliff to the Family Foundation School?
Yes, I remember I got on a plane and we flew into LaGuardia, and I remember they rented a car, and I remember driving from LaGuardia to upstate New York. Then that was really when everything changed. We pulled up at the Family Foundation School. From the outside, it looked great, like a normal boarding school. But as soon as we pulled up, they ushered me and my parents inside. My mom asked for a tour and they said no. They separated us immediately. Again, they took me into a utility type closet, and again, strip searched me, stripped me down, cavity search, cut off all my jewelry, which to me was a huge deal because this was handmade jewelry that I had made in the Wilderness program, like hemp bracelets or and my puaka, which was my Indian medicine bag. I just remember like that being really traumatic. That is when I kind of started to cry, when I came out of that closet. And they actually had a fellow student do the strip search and the cavity search. It was another student at the Family Foundation School.
And even having that jewelry cut off of you is such an obvious sign of, we don't really care. And we're just going to, you know, get this shit off of you and then just to cut it off like that. Mm.
Yeah. I came out and I saw my parents and I just started crying. When the tears started coming, I started crying uncontrollably and I could not stop. They kind of ripped me from my parents and they told my parents, you need to go. And by then I was like full on hysterical crying. And I think that was like the first time I really ever had a panic attack, because it suddenly was hard to breathe and I was crying and it was like very intense. My parents were ushered away. I didn't really get to fully say a goodbye. Then I was taken to a trailer and everything was not what it seemed at all. I can tell you what happened there, but it sounds so unbelievable and so sadistic and so cruel that they could even get away with that and get away with it for so long. And there have been so many complaints against the Family Foundation School. There's been a litany of lawsuits against them. There's a litany of investigations, a litany of child welfare complaints and CPS and DCS and their court records dating back all the way, you know, early 80s, long before I went there.
So people knew.
Yeah. And there was nothing in place to protect the children. There were no phones. We were not allowed to talk to our our family for the first 6 months we were there. I remember thinking, if I could just get a phone call or get a letter out and say green lizards, then I could be saved. My parents will come and get me. That was the first time I got in real trouble. I tried to sneak a letter out with one of the cleaning ladies that worked outside of the school. She told on me and gave the letter. And I remember that feeling. They wrapped me in a blanket and duct tape, and they called it a run plan. And they threw me in the box, wrapped in a blanket with duct tape. And they had this place called the box at the Family Foundation School, and it was like this underneath room, and they had this box in there that kids that were not behaving would get put into. And how some kids horrifying. Would stay there for hours and some kids days. And yeah, it was definitely not a place really for kids at all.
Oh, I can just imagine that feeling of being so stuck somewhere with no way out. And just that despair, it's an utter despair of being trapped like that. What was going through your head? What was going through your mind at this time?
I wanted to talk to my friend, JC, who was my really good friend from Wilderness. I was like so excited to see her. So I was searching her out, like maybe I will have a friend in this and then this won't be so bad. Like, because I wasn't allowed to talk to anybody there. I was on silence, blackout. So I was not allowed to talk to boys. I was not allowed to look at boys or make eye contact with boys. Mm-hmm. They put me and JC specifically on blackout. So I was not allowed to look at her or communicate with her. And she was mm-hmm. the only person that I knew there. People in my family, they all hated me. They kept just telling me, get with the program. You're ruining this. You're taking us down. Table topics would come up, and table topic was a time every night at dinner, you would sit at the table and they would call it table topics. And basically it was just one big roast session. A child would stand up. Everybody would have to go around the room and tear that child down. The girl with the eating disorder, you are fat, you are ugly, you are disgusting. Oh, I saw her look at so-and-so's food today. And if everybody didn't tattletale, then you would be punished. And I didn't really partake in the table topics because I knew they were incredibly abusive. And I knew that that wasn't right because I had just gotten there. I hadn't been there for months and years like all these other kids. And I was also a lot older than these other kids. I was 17. Uh-huh. And a lot of these kids were 9, 10. Some of the kids had been there for 5, 6 years, many years.
Wow, years and years and years. Oh, that is so horrifying. Let's say a new student is enrolled. What is expected of them to be able to leave that center?
Their parents' money has to run out. They won't ever leave until their parents' money runs out.
Oh, how just absolutely.
They had a program for kids. That's why I had gone there for, if you're over 18, that you can stay there and go to school. And they really used to publicize that. And that was one of their selling points. Like, oh, we have lots of kids that go to Binghamton College. And I mean, that was a lie because I remember they put me down in the classroom school and they were doing like some type of GED and it was really remedial stuff for me, at least basic stuff I had learned in eighth grade. Mm-hmm. And I knew the answers and the teacher would get mad at me. And I said, well, I've already graduated high school. And she said, no, you didn't. You are a liar. Nobody here has graduated high school. I said, well, I'm supposed to be going to college. The teacher, of course, got really upset with me and made fun of me in front of all of the students. Somehow the teacher eventually the next day confirmed it, never apologized, of course, and still continued to make me go to these GED classes. Mm-hmm. I mean, that whole time really is such a blur for me because the level of abuse that I endured, I was in such a disassociative state. It's like I was just going through the motions, but some of the motions I just couldn't go through because I realized like this is so abusive and this is so messed up. I just can't participate in this. I can't kick other children. I can't hit other kids. And because I couldn't participate in that abuse, I was targeted. I was the one constantly being abused because I wouldn't participate in the abuse of other children.
Sure.
Which sounds so insane now.
You were immersed in that, though. And I think that that's what people listening should consider, is that you didn't necessarily have an option, right? You were there until further notice.
Yes. So, and I don't blame the kids either that did partake in the abuse, because that wasn't their fault either. Like, they were forced to. And I don't blame the kids that hit me or kicked me, because that wasn't them. They had to do that to survive.
How did you get out of this place?
Well, I kind of remember. So the breaking point was I had another panic attack and I was on the floor in the trailer in my family. I remember the staff in the trailer getting all the kids from my family and circling them all around me. They were going to do an exorcism on me to get the demons out of me. Meanwhile, I'm mid panic attack on the floor, struggling to breathe. And everybody is hitting me and kicking me while repeatedly saying Hail Marys. I don't know how long this went on for. I know several Hail Marys were said, at least 10 or 12. I kind of lost track after a while. But I remember after that incident thinking, I have to get out of here. If I don't get out of here, I am going to kill myself. I will either hurt myself bad enough to end up in the hospital where somehow they will have to contact my parents, or I will kill myself, because I cannot survive this. I cannot emotionally tolerate a minute more of this. I mean, I had to wear a sign around my neck saying I forced my to have sex with me, the family member that had abused me as a child. I had to wear that sign for 2 weeks. I ruined my family and forced my to have sex with me. So I remember after that incident with the exorcism, I started wearing 3 layers of clothing every day, and I made a plan. And I didn't tell anyone because I did not trust anybody. I couldn't trust the staff. I couldn't trust the students, because the students would tell on you too, because they would tell to level up. The students were just as complicit in the, not in a way that I blame them. They were forced to be complicit in order to level up, or in order to not be abused themselves.
Exactly.
So it was just this atrocious cycle, you know, that went in this circle, the circle of abuse. I made a plan. I said, as soon as I see an opening, I will take it. And I don't know how long I wore those triple layers of clothing, at least a week or 2 weeks. And finally, one day, I remember they were lining us up all to shave our heads. My whole family, again, was mad at me. The family foundation school family, they were all mad at me, because everybody had to have their head shaved because gross, disgusting Christy came from the wilderness program and brought lice with her and gave everybody at the school lice. And so now we have to shave everybody's heads because of Christy. Later, this was determined to be another program lie, because I did not have lice. It was later confirmed. But anyways, as we were lining up to all get our head shaved, so as soon as we walked in the trailer door, they would take our shoes from us. There was like a bag. You would take your shoes off and throw it in a bag. So I took my shoes and I kept one shoe and I put it in the trailer door so that the alarm wouldn't go off. Anytime the door opened without a staff member permission, a big alarm, really loud, would go off. So I stuck my shoe in the door and we were all lining up. And at that point, I also had a shadow, which was another peer student that was tasked to be with me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and to watch me every second of the day and to make sure I didn't run. And she would be severely punished.
Right.
I broke a rule or I ran. And my shadow was getting her head shaved and I ran. I pulled my shoe out that door and I started running.
Wow.
And I can remember like the hills. I can remember the grass. It was upstate New York. So it was like very hilly and there was tall grass, like waist high. And I'm running and it's a wide open area from the school, wide for, you know, at least a football field length.
Yeah. So they can see you.
They can see me and I know they can see me. Yeah. So my heart is pounding and I'm racing, you know, it's like a serial killer is chasing after me. And I dared to look back a couple times. Nobody had seen me yet. Nobody was coming and I ran. And I remember that feeling once I hit the trees and could get out of sight, the line of sight.
Yes.
It's like, okay. But I was like, I still have to keep going. I had actually ran the opposite direction of Hancock because when we had first come to the family, the school had told my parents the kids often run away and they run to Hancock, New York, the next town over. Everybody in Hancock knew any teenager that they didn't recognize was from the family foundation school. And they would call the police and they would turn in those kids. So I ran the opposite direction of Hancock, which I had always thought was, I had ran to Long Eddy, which recently I found out I actually ran all the way to Equinox, Pennsylvania, which is much farther than I thought I had ran. I used the skills I learned at Wilderness. I was barefoot. I didn't have my shoes. I had left my shoe in the trailer door. I ran barefoot, bloody, twigs scraping at me, rocks. Yeah. I didn't feel it. It didn't hurt. I had so much adrenaline pumping through my body. I just ran and ran. I found a river. I later found out, you know, it was the Delaware River. So I just beelined the Delaware River because I had learned that in Wilderness, you know, to beeline a river and right. You will eventually find your way to some sort of civilization or some sort of way of getting help. So I beelined the Delaware River for several miles and I ended up sleeping in the woods that first night. I felt safe for the first time in a long time. I felt safe, scraped up, bloody, hungry, cold, no blankets.
Yeah.
And I felt safe. I felt safer than I had ever felt at the Family Foundation School. The next morning I woke up and I continued beelining the Delaware River. I heard a road in the distance, so cars. So I kind of stayed out of line of sight of the cars because I was worried. I knew like they're looking for me. And if they find me, I'm going to die. Like they will lock me in the box for like a month. For running. If you try to escape, you get punished so badly that all the other punishments I had endured up to this point were nothing compared to the punishment of an escape, an actual escape.
Right. And probably the fact that you made it successfully would add even more fury to the punishment, right? And
yeah. Yes. So I remember I came upon a tiny little town and there was this old dilapidated white broke down post office and this old general type store, like a convenience store. And there was a payphone on the side by the post office. I was like, yes, I can call my parents. I can call for help. And I picked up the payphone and it was silent on the other end. Like that feeling like, again, I've been let down. Are you kidding me? There's no working payphone. Like, I was like, well, what am I going to do? And I was so desperate by this time. Like, I needed help. I was in a weird state. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a phone. I didn't have access to any help or any person. So I took a risk and I went into that general store. I asked the store owner if she knew where a working phone was or if I could use one. And she asked me, are you from the Family Foundation School? My heart paused and my heart beat rapidly. And I was so scared. Like, should I tell her? Because the town people, they all call the police and they all send the kids back.
Right.
And something in me trusted that woman. Something about her, her demeanor, her attitude, the way she looked, something about her made me feel like I could trust her. And so I told her, yes, I am. I said, and I need to call my parents. And she said, I know that school is a horrible place. It is so abusive. Everybody in this town knows how abusive the Family Foundation School is. She let me use the phone and I tried to call my parents. They, of course, again, nobody answers the phone at their house.
As you're just like, I am in utter emergency. Like, please.
Please help. Like, I couldn't remember any phone numbers. I had nothing on me. I had already been in the wilderness for how long? Right. And then in the Family Foundation for how long? I couldn't remember any phone numbers. I suddenly remembered my aunt's phone number. So I called her up. I don't even know what I said to her, but I know somehow she got a hold of my parents who were out of town in Dallas, I believe. The store owner let me stay at her house for 2 nights, 3 days while my parents tried to make travel arrangements to sneak me out of New York State because the Family Foundation School was threatening my parents because my parents had signed over legal custody to the Family Foundation School.
Oh, God.
They were telling my parents again, if you don't send her back, she's going to end up dead in jail in institutions. Like, she's manipulating. She's lying. You need to send her back. Thankfully, my saving grace was never calling for help at the wilderness program. Because if I would have said anything bad happened at the wilderness program, nobody would have believed me about the Family Foundation School. Mm-hmm. And the wilderness program wasn't great either. But it was nothing compared to the Family Foundation School at all. That lady, she ended up driving me 3 hours to the Binghamton Airport. She stayed. She had a child that was a couple years younger than me. We talked a lot. She told me a lot of stories about the school and kids that had been abused and one kid that had ran. And instead of the school was about to catch him, and instead he jumped in front of a train and died.
How horrible.
You know, she told me all kinds of stories about the fam, and she believed me. Having that person there for me in that time was like such a saving grace, because if I hadn't crossed paths with that woman, I don't even think I probably would be alive today, because I don't think I could have mentally or physically endured any more of what the Family Foundation School was dishing out to me. And I wasn't going to conform in the abusive way and taking part in the abuse of other children that they had wanted. It was really a saving grace with that lady.
That's so incredible. And I know that she was put on your path there for a reason. There's not a lot of people, maybe there's some now in 2020, many years later, that would just take in a child like that and help, right? Instead of reporting. I'm sure that was such a fear in that moment of, is she pretending to be nice? But then behind the scenes, she's calling FFS.
Right. But I knew once the police came into the store and she hid me in the back of this. So her house was attached to the store. So the store was in the front and then her residence was in the back. And she hid me in the back when the police came. It took like 2 days before the police showed up. They'd probably gone to Hancock and all the other towns.
And so even the police are looking for you.
Yes. Which is crazy, because the school still at this point had never notified my parents that I was missing or that I had ran. Never. So when my parents got a phone call from me, imagine their shock and dismay to find out that I'm the one calling them, not the Family Foundation School. They were pretty livid at the school when they got a hold of the school. Like, why didn't you tell us that our daughter has been missing? Like,
yep.
Why didn't you notify us? So my parents were pretty easily able to see through the bullshit, thank goodness. My mom had said that she had a really bad feeling about the school from the moment they dropped me off there. She just had a bad feeling, which in hindsight, like any parent, really, I mean, you can't take a tour of a school. You can't go and look around. I mean, what are they hiding?
Right. I mean, anyone, yes, I completely get that. Anyone would feel that way. And, you know, in hindsight, maybe, and I'm just thinking this as I'm listening to your story, perhaps the Family Foundation School did not want to tell your parents because they had other plans for when they found you. they didn't want to have to then put you in contact with your parents and all of that, which then, of course, you would tell them what had been happening. What a wild ride. So you said that the Family Foundation School was contacting your parents because they technically had custody of you?
Yes. I am not sure how much of this is exactly true legally or technically, because now as an adult and what I know about custody and guardianship, I know now that you can rescind that at any time as a legal guardian, even if you do assign another custodian. But I know my parents assigned over legal custody to Family Foundation School until I was 19 years old, because apparently at that date in New York State, 19 was the age of consent for treatment of that sort. Yeah, so I know that was like a real fear of my parents. I know that was a real fear of mine. Like, I don't even know. I didn't have ID. I didn't have any type of money. I had nothing on me when I got on the airplane. I don't even remember if I flew under my real name, because I remember that we did fly to North Carolina first. And I remember I had to lie to everybody, lie to the lady who had helped me about my final destination. Like, just in case, because we didn't know the extent the Family Foundation was going to go to come and get me.
Right. Again. Absolutely.
And that was like a very real fear. So I got on that plane. I had a stopover in North Carolina. I flew all by myself after going through this incredibly tough experience. The lady drives me to Binghamton Airport. I get on the airplane all by myself, 17 years old.
Yeah.
Fly, have a stopover in North Carolina, and then land in Utah. My parents had contacted the Wilderness Program. Well, you told us this school was a good school. What's going on? Somehow it was decided that I would be hidden in a foster home until I turned 18 years old in Utah. Wow. So I got...
But you didn't even go back home to your parents.
No, because the Family Foundation School could find me, is what I was told. That the Family Foundation School could find me and they could take me back and I couldn't go home.
What an utter nightmare.
And I don't even remember landing in Utah. I don't even remember that. I do remember before going to the foster home, I remember getting taken to a doctor because I had bruises and marks and all kinds of trauma documented all over my body. Mm-hmm. So I do remember them taking photographs and like evidencing it, but not to evidence it to show the level of abuse I had endured, but to document it, to show that the foster family did not do this abuse to me.
Okay.
This is why it was documented. Right. Not for my own good, mm-mm, but again, to protect the program and to protect Utah and what was going on there in their facilities.
Oh, man. So you ended up staying. How was this foster family? You ended up staying with the foster family until you're 18.
Jan and Dave, the husband was a really great guy. The wife, I liked her too, and I don't blame her. They ended up saying I was too much. And I went into independent living like a week before I turned 18. But they have little kids in the home and I would like break down and just curl into a ball and hide in the closet and cry. Yeah. For hours. So that was probably a lot. They didn't sign up for that as a foster family. They have little kids in their home, like 2 and 4 year olds. But all this trauma I had gone through, it was like never talked about again. Like, I got on this plane, I end up in this foster home. Did my family come and see me? Did they call? Did they check? Did we ever talk about the escape or the Family Foundation School ever again? No, it was never brought up again. It's never been brought up, not even 20 years later. It's like water under the bridge. It never happened.
So do they even know the extent of the, and I'm just going to call it what it is, the torture that you were going through there?
I mean, they know. I remember on the phone when I was with that lady and I was trying to explain. I mean, I told them some of the things. I don't know what exactly I told them. It's been so many years, but I know ever since I landed foot in Utah again, that it was never talked about. In fact, my own siblings didn't even know. They thought I was in boarding school or in some plush rehab center.
You're just feeling, I'm sure, completely alone.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I've been my whole life, completely alone.
Oh, I can relate to that on so many levels in my own journey. And I think that that's a narrative that I've carried with myself for so long, is that I'm always alone. I always have to do everything on my own. Yeah. Right. And I think a lot of that stems back from experiences like that. So how did you find some sense of normalcy after all of that?
Well, so then I started college in Utah, pretended like nothing ever happened. I had some medical issues. I had a bone infection that had come from a broken leg that didn't heal right, or that didn't get the proper doctor care. And I got a bone infection in it and almost lost my leg and ended up in a like a rehab type center for mostly old folks. I mean, everybody there was like over 70. I was the youngest person there. I was like 18 years old, just turned 18, you know, and I was in there because I had a PICC line in my arm. Oh, right. And they wouldn't let me leave. I couldn't go on visits because, of course, I was a heroin addict. Right. Oh, and I had a PICC line. I had to stay in the facility to get my medical, my PICC line flush and the IV medications that I needed, like, given to me. And of course, I was giving like no pain meds during this whole.
Right. Because you're a heroin addict.
Yeah. Because I'm a heroin addict who had, you know, at this point, I was really more just like experimenting. Like, yeah, I had tried a couple of harder drugs prior to the experimental, but no, I was not by any means like a hardcore heroin addict at all.
Even if you were, though, even if you were, situations like that, that's inhumane, right? You can't treat people just any way that you see fit because you don't believe that they are deserving of having some kind of pain management. I mean, you broke your leg.
No, my mom made sure to tell all the doctors. She was always like the first one to tell everybody about all of my problems and what a terrible kid I was and how, I had mental issues and this and that. And, you know, so
that's just living in, this is just a shadow over you, it sounds like, for the, you know, beginning of your life. So, okay, I'm sorry. I kind of cut you off there, but you're staying in this kind of like assisted living center with this bone infection. And then what happens?
At some point I ended up getting out of it and I started partying a little bit, going to raves. And I mean, I was actually going to raves sober. I was smoking cigarettes. So to me, that was like really bad. I was smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back home. So, and my roommate, who I was very close to at the time in Utah, and she had cared for me very well when I had a broken leg. She was like the mom. She was always taking care of me. And she left to go home. When she left to go back to her state of residence, I decided that I would go home to California. And at the time, I was living with my other best friend, Eric, who was also a program kid who had gone to the wilderness program. And he had actually hooked up with my other best friend who I was living with. After all three of us were living together, the two of them ended up hooking up. Then they end up breaking up, which is why everybody decided to go home. So me and Eric went home to California together. He was from Orange County area. I was from Santa Barbara. So like we drove all the way down to like Barstow and then like split ways. And we kept in contact for a few years. So I went home, but that didn't work out because that is what caused all my issues in the place. I, you know, had a very dysfunctional family. My mother, quite frankly, she's a narcissist. Mm-hmm. She wasn't capable of giving love. Mm-hmm. She withheld love. It was just a very toxic childhood to grow up in, to always know you're not good enough. You're never good enough. You're nobody. You're nothing. Just like constantly getting that, like any feelings that you have are not validated. You're not allowed to feel anything. Like, always have a smile on your face and act like everything is okay. And if you don't, then there will be hell to pay. And I was like the black sheep in my family. Everybody in my family hated me. My brother hated me. My sisters hated me. I mean, maybe I wasn't really likable back then. I mean, because nobody liked me. So I kept thinking, you know, when nobody likes you, how can the issue be everybody else, right? It's got to be me.
Right.
Because why does nobody else in my family like me? I ended up moving up to Washington State after I went home to California. I stayed there for maybe a month or two. I did not last very long. Mm-hmm. And I came up to Washington State to go to college. And I pretended like nothing ever happened for 4 years. And I graduated college. Life was good. Then that senior year, actually, right before I graduated, I started partying. Then I got into heavy drugs. Then I actually did become a real heroin addict because I had always been told if you do it once, then you have to do it all day, every day. And it was so ingrained into my head. Like, I'm an addict, so I can't just experiment. I just can't have fun with
right. You already have that. Yeah. I mean, for years that had been pushed on you, right? Yeah. To a point where you had already accepted that as a part of your identity. Right. Yeah. And you know, what we know now in psychology is that when you're told something over and over and over and over and over again, you're eventually going to start acting and fitting into that role. But do you feel like at that time you were trying to self-medicate from the experiences?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like all the abuse and the trauma and then just getting traumatized by my family. Yeah. Over and over again, reaching out, trying to get my voice heard, telling about sexual abuse, mm-hmm. like telling about trauma, telling about being hurt, and nobody listened. Nobody ever listened. It was always just me, mm-hmm. all alone. And if I said something, then I was the bad guy. Oh, there's Christy, like making a big stink out of stuff again. Oh, you know, mm-hmm. there's Christy dragging down the vibe. I was always the black sheep and I was never good enough. I wasn't worthy of love. And I believed that for a long time, that I wasn't worthy of love. I was unlovable and I was just a piece of shit is what I thought. And that's why I did start self-medicating. And you know what? Heroin loved me. It would always love me. It would always be there for me. And what better thing to numb your feelings than something like that?
Absolutely. I mean, they say even with like, let's just say, you know, ibuprofen or Tylenol, that physical pain reliever also works as an emotional pain reliever. I experienced something very similar in my story. Several years after I got out of these programs, I fell into addiction. I fell into heroin addiction. I fell into meth addiction. I mean, you name it. I had abused it at one point, but it was the only time, I will tell you this. And of course I'm not, you know, advocating for addiction or anything, but it was the only time that I felt okay.
Yeah.
It was the only time that I felt like my mind and my body were quiet enough that I could just sit and watch a TV show or I could just exist. Yep. Yeah.
And you felt at peace, not that heightened flight or fight mode.
Or constantly feeling like there's about to be a tragedy or there's about to be some emergency, right? I was always on the verge of being prepared for an emergency. And so eventually what I found out is that these were actually symptoms for me of complex PTSD.
Yep. Same.
Yeah. Yep. And so once I started researching about hypervigilance, I'm like, oh my God, that is what I do. That is me to a T. And it made so much sense after all of that came together. So tell me, when did you start realizing maybe I wasn't the problem? Maybe that was wrong what happened to me.
So I always knew like that the Family Foundation School was an insanely messed up place. I thought I always deserved that and I deserved to be there. And it really honestly, even though I have been around watching like the fight to end these programs for many years now, and I've been in alumni and survivor groups since the beginning of them, I still always thought I was just unlovable and I wasn't worthy of love and nobody liked me and everybody hated me. It's just because I'm an unlovable piece of crap. And I started to have friends, and I have a lot of friends that are like family, and they're great. Mm-hmm. And I realized, like, it's so weird, right? Because I have all these friends, and you would think if I'm such an unlovable piece of shit, Like, why do all these great, amazing people like me and they like my company and they like to be around me?
Right. So it's not adding up. You're realizing that doesn't add up because yeah. I've been told this other thing my whole life, but yet I'm seeing that people do love and like and care about me.
Yes. And then I'm noticing every time I go home to visit, I'm made to feel that exact same way again. I'm just the black sheep. I'm unlovable. I'm ostracized. Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. You know, just those feelings again and internalizing all that self-hatred into me. And so then I would notice because I would go home and I would feel like that. And then the second I would get back in Washington State, it would be like, oh, I can be myself again and I'm a good person and, you know, I mentor kids and I coach sports and I have all these friends and I'm active in my community. I'm active in the PGA. I'm active in all these different things. People that know me respect me locally. Anybody that doesn't know my family and isn't involved in my family knows me, loves me, and respects me. But anybody that knows anybody in my family doesn't like me, they don't love me, and they certainly don't respect me. So I started, you know, really realizing this, but it really wasn't until about 3 years ago when I was made aware by other siblings that were in therapy that my mother was a narcissist. And that was when click. And then I started to get a little bit angry, like, because it wasn't me. It wasn't me as a teenager.
Never you.
It wasn't me. I wasn't unlovable. I wasn't a piece of crap. Like, I was actually, you know, doing everything to try to be perfect for my mom. All growing up, it was just never good enough. Never. The straight A's, being the best in sports, being the best. It was never enough, no matter how much I did, it was just never good enough.
I just want to add to that real quick, because I have narcissistic family as well. And so I've also kind of, been on a similar journey there. But it's interesting when you have that realization that it was actually never about the grades. It was never about you playing sports. It was never about you at all. Because that has been the foundation of your understanding of yourself. And so then to zoom out and see yourself from a different perspective and actually allow yourself to love yourself or to have a different idea of yourself, that is so incredibly transformative.
Yes, it was incredibly validating to realize that all these years, it wasn't me. It wasn't me at all. Like, in every relationship that my mom has been involved in has turned to complete shit. Anybody that knows my mom, I don't really have a relationship with outside of my mom because we weren't allowed to. Me and my siblings weren't really allowed to hang out without my mom. We weren't allowed to have relationships without my mom. Like, even to this day, if I call home, my dad will put my mom on speakerphone. My mom wants to sit in on the conversation.
Everything.
And control the narrative. It was just incredibly validating. And then to read up about narcissism and then to realize how hard I got gaslit to actually believe for so many years that I was the problem. I was a drug addict. I was the bad kid. I had all these issues. No, I was the identified patient.
Mm-hmm.
The dysfunctional, it was from my family system, from everybody that was complicit in my sexual abuse. All the adults that stood around and let that happen and did not speak up and continued to let it happen and forced me to continue to see my abuser. All of those adults, they were the complicit ones. They, if anything, they were the ones that were messed up, not me. So it was very validating for me just to realize that.
Well, I'm sure just freeing, you know, it's like, holy shit. Okay. Wow. This nightmare that I've been living in, I don't have to live in anymore. I just want to thank you so deeply. If I could reach through this microphone and this screen and give you a hug, I would. Your story is so incredible and you are such a powerful person. Thank you for sharing and gracing us with the trials that you went through in your life that has ultimately brought you to this place of freedom. Thank you so dearly for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.